I was told that Howie, who came and spoke last week, gave a very nice talk, and he talked about, if I got it right, he talked about just being in the present moment. And I think that's, you know, kind of the heart of much spiritual practice, certainly Buddhist spiritual practice, is a deep appreciation of the present moment and the possibilities and potential that arise from waking up and being present in the present moment and learning to appreciate it, to enjoy it, to love it. And one aspect of the present moment which is very important is that the present moment is a creative moment. There's a possibility for creativity there. And this creativity that's possible in the present moment, in the juncture of what's called the present, is connected to what in Buddhism is called karma. And I thought that it would be interesting to spend a little bit of time today talking about the Buddhist teachings of karma. And partly I was inspired for this because there were some questions 2 weeks ago on intention and karma. So I wanted to follow that theme up a little bit. And I'll start by telling you, reading a koan, or a Zen story, a teaching story. And in certain schools of Zen, they have these koans, these spiritual questions or statements which are the student then grapples with to kind of penetrate, to understand in a different way. And this koan here is the first koan in some schools of Zen, first koan that a student will come to terms with after their first experience of realization, the first kensho or enlightenment experience. So it's very significant that this is the one that they give first after a person has had some taste of freedom. And it's called Yakujo and the Fox. And it goes this way. When the abbot Yakujo gave a lecture on Zen, an old man sat listening with the monks and always left when they did. One day, however, the old man stayed behind, and Yakujo asked him, "Who are you standing here before me?" The old man answered, "I am not a human being. In the distant past, I was the head of this monastery. Once, a monk asked me, 'Does an enlightened person fall under the law of karma or not?' I replied, 'Such a person does not fall under the law of karma. Because of this answer, I was reborn as a fox for 500 lives.'" So be careful with what you say. And then he continues, "Please tell me the turning words that will release me from this fox body." Then he asked Yakujo, "Does an enlightened person fall under the law of karma?" And Yakujo replied, "Such a person does not ignore karma." Hearing this, the old man was immediately enlightened and, bowing to Yakujo, said, "I have now been released from this fox body." And then he goes on, and he says, "Please go out behind the mountain tomorrow, and next to this big rock, you'll find the body of a dead fox. And please take that fox and bring it back to the monastery and bury it with the honors of a monk." Because he'd been released. So somehow or other, the answer that an enlightened person is not subject or does not fall under the law of cause and effect of karma created the cosmic consequence of him being reborn 500 times as a fox. And the answer, which freed him from this constant rebirth as a fox, was the answer, an enlightened person does not ignore karma. So this is so I think it's very easy for people who have had some kind of moment of freedom to dwell kind of in the present moment in the free way, to feel, oh, they're above and beyond cause and effect of karma, the laws of karma, and they can do whatever they want. And so in Zen tradition, they give this koan to the student to make sure that they understand this very important point of karma. It's interesting, it goes on, there's a commentary that follows this koan. And the commentary says, "Not falling under the law of karma. Why did he fall into the life of a fox? Not ignoring karma. Why was he released from the fox body? If you have the eyes to understand all this, then you will know that the former abbot lived 500 happy years as a fox. And usually people think that, you know, it's kind of a drag to end up as a fox. So it's important, I think, in Buddhism to try to understand the concept, the Buddhist concept of karma. And it's important to understand that the concept of karma in Buddhism is not some special idea or fancy idea about past lives. You know, and you try to figure out your past lives, and that's what karma is about. And it's also not a theory about justice. It doesn't, you know, in the West in particular, we have very concerned about justice. And it's very hard to see how justice could happen in this world when some people get away with some things and other people don't get away with anything. And or things happen to people who doesn't seem like it should happen to them. It doesn't seem fair. It's not a theory of fairness. Even the Westerners often try to find a way to make that be the case. It's maybe a closest thing that Buddhism has to offer to just the idea of justice or fairness, kind of cosmic fairness. But to be too strict about this is to put it, is to demand of the Buddhist law of karma more than it's been set up to explain. It's also not a law of predetermination. It isn't that everything that happens to you today is because of things that you've done in the past. And this is a very important point, especially in the world. And I hear a lot of people in the world of illness feel that, oh, you know, I got cancer, therefore, you know, I must have done something that caused me to get cancer. Because we've read so much now about how attitude might affect our illnesses and our activities and our lifestyles and everything. So people often want to take responsibility for what is not their responsibility. And people sometimes use the Indian notion of karma to add to that false sense of blame. But karma doesn't, Buddhist law of karma is not, doesn't say that everything is determined today by your actions in the past, and you're responsible for anything that happens to you today. The teaching of karma is a subcategory of the Buddhist teaching on causality, of cause and effect. And Buddhism puts tremendous emphasis on causality because in Buddhism, nothing exists independently. And everything that exists, in a sense, exists in dependence on other causes and conditions around it. So it belongs to a world of interdependence, it's an interactive world, intersupportive world, interactive world, interconditioned world, interdependent world. And as a person in mindfulness wakes up to this wider interdependent world, it becomes a world that awakens, I think, compassion, caring, loving, and a call to awaken, a call to help other people. But the laws of causality are not one and the same as laws of karma. Laws of causality, you know, could be are many and varied, how things come into being. And it said, the Buddha said, even just the laws of karma, not even the laws of causality, karma being a subcategory of causality, if you think too much about it, it's conducive to becoming crazy. Because it's very hard to understand and figure out how causality moves through our lives and how it moves through reality. The Buddhist understanding of karma is best understood in contrast with some of the other ideas of karma that existed in time of the Buddha. And when the Buddha, in his sermons, he actually contrasted, he talked about some of the other theories of karma that existed in his time. And when he talked about this, he said, he didn't talk about karma kind of generally, but he said rather, there are three theories for understanding how happiness and unhappiness, how happiness and suffering occur in people's lives. And one way is, one theory is that it's controlled by the gods. And you better treat them well. And if you don't treat the gods properly, you know, thunderbolts will come down and they'll ruin your crops and all kinds of horrible things will happen. And so the ancient Indians spent a lot of time supplicating the gods and doing rituals of offerings and trying to get the gods on their side. And that was something the Buddha said was what something he was critical of. He wasn't this, the world of happiness and unhappiness, of suffering and freedom, wasn't something that gods had any responsibility in or any effect on. So he criticized that. The other notion of karma, or happiness and unhappiness, is that it's predetermined in some form or other. That there's some predetermined idea or map of reality or plan. So somehow it was set in motion long ago, and we're just kind of riding along, surfing along this predetermined whatever's supposed to happen. So if you have, you know, if you break your leg, it's well, it was supposed to happen. That's the way it was meant to be. And if you fall in love, well, it was meant to fall. You were meant to do that or whatever. And you're not responsible for what happens to you. You're just kind of riding along. Related to this theory is the idea that everything that happens to you today is a result of your past karma, your past actions. And there's mechanical rigidity, mechanical relationship between what you've done in the past and what happens to you today. The third theory that the Buddha criticized is that your happiness and unhappiness is dependent. How it arises, how it comes to be, cannot be determined. It's a random, it's by chance, it's just plain old luck. And so you kind of just rumble along this life and things happen, and it's not predetermined, but it's not something you have any control over, and just things happen, and if you're lucky, you'll win the lottery. The Buddha said once, anyone who says, this person has performed this karma, and so now is subject to this karma, the consequences of this karma, leaves no room for leading the spiritual life, because she or he is blind to the way, to the path that leads to complete elimination of suffering. If you say that your present life and your consequences, the conditions of your present life, your happiness in the present life, is completely conditioned by what's happened before, what you've done before. It's kind of a predetermined kind of situation. It doesn't leave any space for you to have any effect on that, on your happiness and your suffering. And the Buddha felt it was very important. He insisted that there is a realm of choice that is that spiritual, the Buddhist spiritual life resides in. And that if you have too strict of an idea of karma, there's no room for choice. Karma, Buddhist teaching on karma has to do with this point of choice that happens in the present moment. So the present moment, the appreciation that Buddhism offers for the present moment, points in part to the choice that's offered or that's possible in the present moment also. The present moment isn't that simply only something to be enjoyed and to be relaxed into, but there exists the possibility in the present moment to choose how to step forward into the next moment. And that choice is what affects our happiness and our suffering. And taking responsibility for that choice is a very important part of a Buddhist spiritual life. So the Buddha redefined very clearly in the suttas what he called karma. He said, what I call karma is intention. What I call karma is intention. It's not, you know, past actions or it's not actions, but it's just one narrow part of our life, which is the intentional part of our life, the motivations of why we do things and how we do things. And intentions can be powerfully consequential. Even if they're not acted on. It's said that if you have a thought, if thoughts by themselves have no karma, have no intentional consequence, have no consequences, you just have a simple thought by itself, just kind of appears there without. But if you get into your thought, like if you think about, if you think about ice cream, and you have a thought that wouldn't be nice to have an ice cream, and then you spend the next half an hour scheming in all the possible ways you can steal ice cream from the store, or all the, you just kind of go into, your craving, your desire for ice cream. The participation, the fueling, the acting on that thought and participating in it, that creates certain kind of consequence down the line. And how that consequence, the consequences that intention sets up is not very clear. But I'll talk about that. So, in talking about karma, the Buddha didn't focus on past actions so much, or hardly at all, but put emphasis on the present moment and the choice that's made in the present. So the karma, the theory of karma in Buddhism, is not to help you kind of look back into the past and understand what you did in the past so much, but really is pointing to the present and the choices we make here and now. And the here and now in Buddhism is so important because this is the place, this is the nexus, this is the cauldron of where suffering and happiness has a genesis. So the conditions and the circumstances of the present moment we find ourselves in, is simply what is. It's what we find ourselves in. It's what has arisen around us. Once the present moment has arisen, that's what you have. And the next moment, or the next minute, or the next day, is conditioned in part on the choices we make in relationship to what we find ourselves in right now. So, so the karma is about what we do with where we find ourselves, what we do with what the world brings us, both our inner world and the world around us. And intended acts of speech, of mind, of body, carry consequences. And it's taking into account the consequences that's a very important part of a Buddhist spiritual life. But these consequences are not fixed or mechanical consequences. And I have some ambivalence about using the expression the law of karma. You find many Western books on Buddhism that talk about the law of karma, the law of karma. And as far as I can tell, the word the law of karma doesn't exist in the sutras. The Buddha didn't use the expression law of karma. He just talked about karma. But in my mind, when you add the word law, it's like this fixed, absolute thing. It's like legislated. This is the way it has to be. And I think that's the way often it's taken then by people, is that there are particular consequences, fixed consequences of certain actions, of certain intended actions. And when I read the teachings of the Buddha, he seems over and over again to want to qualify and say, no, it's not fixed. It's more like certain intended actions tend towards certain consequences, rather than that they absolutely have to go in certain directions. Because if we find ourselves, you know, the field of causality, of cause and effect, is really huge. And in our intended actions is just one ripple in this huge field of the ocean, of the causal nexus, causal kind of connectedness that we find ourselves in. So sometimes an intended action is lost in that wide ocean of causality. And the Buddha said that sometimes the consequences of certain act are so insignificant, you might not even notice it. But other times, the consequences of your acts are really obvious. I mean, it's like, you know, it hits you in the face. If you're a little bit in a hurry and you're driving your car and you really, you know, your intention is to really get somewhere as fast as you can because you don't want to be late or something, that kind of greed for time and getting somewhere has certain intentions. There can be a very concrete intention of that when you run into the other car. But I notice in my own driving that there are times that where I've narrowly missed an accident, and I could honestly probably say in court that I wasn't responsible. Like it happened the other day, someone ran a stop sign, and if I had been just a little bit more of in a hurry, I probably would have been out in the middle of the intersection, and I would have I would have won the suit or whatever they do, because the person ran the red light, the stop sign. But I could see, I could see that if I had just been a little more in a hurry than I was, a little more anxious about getting where I wanted to go, I wouldn't have had the presence of mind to have maybe noticed this person kind of barreling through the intersection. And so I would say that in some ways I would have been responsible for that accident also. and having had to, it was a consequence of my intention. But more important, the consequence of intention is always, in Buddhism, always starts with the doer. The external world and what might and might not happen there is kind of has to do with many, many conditions coming together. But there's an inner consequence which sometimes is clear. So, for example, if I'm in a rush driving somewhere, that I'll arrive in a harried way if I'm rushing to get there. And that's an internal consequence of that intention of being caught up. It was very interesting to me this morning when I was doing my meditation. At the end of my sitting, I decided to open my eyes as mindfully as I could. So I kind of sat there and brought my, to end the sitting, then I brought my attention to my eyes, and then I mindfully opened my eyes and just did seeing, just allowed seeing to happen. It was kind of nice to do that. And then there was just kind of suddenly this surge within me of, let's get something done. let's get up and, get this day going. And I could feel, because I was present enough, I could feel the surge of that energy. It was kind of stressful, mildly stressful, but I could feel the surge kind of mildly stressful. Like, woof! So I just sat there and felt it, and it kind of very, very quickly dissipated. And then in my own good time, I decided when to get up, not my anxiety. So there's often consequences really close for the doer itself. And we feel it often in our body. I think one place to look for some of the consequences of karma, of intended acts, is in our body itself. To live a stressful life, to be full of fear or full of greed or whatever, can have an effect in the way we hold ourselves, our posture. And the cumulative tendencies, the cumulative habits of greed, hate, delusion, of generosity, of love, of peace, affects the muscles of our body. So if you feel tense and tight because you're always afraid, you're protecting yourself. To protect yourself is an intention, right? You have an intention there to protect yourself. So if you're constantly protecting yourself, you do that for 20 years, and your shoulders are constantly being pulled in, and then you get arthritis in your shoulders. That's a kind of karmic consequence that might occur. So what the Buddha said was that certain intended actions tend towards certain consequences. Actions which tend towards if we practice greed, hate, and delusion, those tend towards different consequences than if we practice generosity and peacefulness and loving kindness. And it's both within us, the habit formations that can build up over a lifetime to create a personality, and they're also externally. The world tends to respond differently to us if we meet the world with greed, hate, and delusion. The world tends to respond to us in a different way entirely if we meet the world with friendliness and kindness. So the world tends to be consequences, is what the Buddha said. He never wanted to say there were absolute consequences from our actions. So repeated attitudes, if you repeat attitudes over and over again, then this could be called, for some people, depending how you define it, a personality that gets built up. The conditioned parts of our personality get created out of many intended acts. It can be very small acts, but repeating them day after day, hour after hour, minute after minute, creates a certain kind of personality, which then affects the world around us. And I thought I should mention that in Buddhism they have three basic personality types. Actually six, but usually they give only three. And then in Asia especially, you're asked to kind of reflect a little bit about yourself. which of these three do you fall into? And because different people have different tendencies. There's the desire or the greed type, which is kind of actually also my, you know, that's my operating mode more than the other two. And then the other one is the aversion type. And the third is the delusion type, the ignorant type. And then some of us think we're all three. But actually, so, you know, that just means you have a healthy balance. But for whatever reasons, we tend to form, you know, different people tend to have different types. And it's kind of interesting to know what type you are if you are a type. You know, so I tend to be the desire type, the greed type. I want things. Other people I know are the aversion type. They tend to look at the world in angry ways. And so Buddhist psychology, these manuals of psychology where they describe how you're supposed to notice, how you can tell what kind of type people are. And so if the people eat in certain ways, you can see the way they eat whether they're one of the three types. Or the way they walk. And one of the things is the way they walk into a room is one of the classic things. So desire type will go into a room and will look around and see, you know, what's desirable in that room. Who should they sit next to that's really nice? Or what's the best chair or the best position to kind of, what's, you know, this kind of, that's their operating mode. The aversion type comes in and looks and sees what's wrong with the room. You know, who they want to avoid. You know, and, you know, and the delusion type comes into the room and is just confused, you know, like, what should I do, and what should I say, and where am I? So mindfulness practice, which is a practice of paying attention to what's happening in the present moment, one of the things it shows us is it shows us the realm of choice. It shows us there is choice in the present moment. And that choice is something we have some control over and affect us. If anything anything qualifies as a self in Buddhism, and there's no self in Buddhism, but if anything should qualify, it has to do with intention, our choices we make. So one of the things that happens in meditation is we stop in ourselves from our normal habitual acting out, and watch the momentum of the mind, the momentum of our desires, our wants, our feelings, our thoughts, and our intentions. Because if we don't stop and take a good look, the tendency for most of us is just to kind of, in some level or other, to go on automatic pilot. Some days it's really gross, and some days, you know, we're basically in control, but it's very subtle, the automatic pilot. But if you stop meditation and just pay attention and don't act on what you're, you know, on all the movements of the mind begins showing itself. It's kind of the mind begins showing its momentum, its desires, its aversions, its intentions, its all these things, and they don't go anywhere because we're not acting on them in meditation. So they kind of have a chance to fall away and relax. They're not being reinforced, refueled over and over again. So, for example, you know, my sitting this morning, because I was more mindful than usual about getting up from my meditation, I could see that I was my first impulse to get up from meditation was this anxious desire to get things done. And so I was in this mode of not, you know, acting on, you know, kind of not being on this automatic pilot. So I just sat there and allowed that to dissipate and then was able to get up in a more mindful and conscious way. People who don't see these choices that exist in the present moment, don't see that they have choices, don't have choices. And are therefore a product of circumstances, both personal circumstances and social, environmental circumstances, much more. And I wanted to tell the story of Angulimala, in part because it talks about this, I think, about how people who don't see that there's choices don't have choices. And I was also thinking, it was such a big impact on me this last week, the photograph of Richard Allen Davis in the Chronicle, and the kind of person that would do that. And, you know, people who don't see a choice don't have a choice for what they do. So Angulimala, killed 999 people. He was a mass murderer in the time of the Buddha. And his goal was to kill 1,000 people. And he had a necklace where he would string one finger from each of his victims. So he had 999 fingers on his necklace. And mala means necklace, and anguli means finger. And he was, he lived in this forest, and the villagers stayed away from there because they were afraid of this guy. But he was the Buddha, with his abilities, could foresee that this man was going to do. Not only when he found his 1,000th victim, and he was a particularly terrible person to kill, so the Buddha wanted to intervene. So the Buddha went and went there, and the villagers said, "You can't go in there; he'll kill you." And he said, "It's okay." And so the Buddha went into this forest and was just doing his walking meditation through the forest. And Angulimala kind of saw the Buddha and said, "Oh, great, here's one of these, passive monk types. It'll be an easy victim." And so he started kind of running up to the Buddha. And as he was running, the Buddha just kept walking mindfully and slowly kind of down the path. And the faster Angulimala ran, the further away the Buddha went, the further away the Buddha was. And no matter how fast he ran, he just couldn't catch up to the Buddha, who was walking very slowly, mindfully. And so finally he yelled out in frustration, "Hey you, stop!" And the Buddha turned around and said, "I stopped long ago. Why don't you stop?" And that caught his attention. And so he realized, perhaps, how his mind had been running all these years, and how he wasn't in control of himself. He wasn't living in a world of choice. He was living in the world of his conditioning, of his anger, of his fear, of his whatever. But his mind hadn't stopped to take a look, to be free, to see. He didn't see. He hadn't stopped long enough to see the choice that exists. And the impact of the Buddha showed him, oh, there's a choice here. There's another possibility. And so then the story continues that then he asked to become the Buddha's disciple, student, and was ordained as a monk, and in relatively short order became fully enlightened. Which is quite a story of the possibility of rehabilitation. It said later in his life, Angulimala was walking on alms rounds through one of the villages where he'd killed a lot of people. And when they saw him, the villagers stoned him. And he just continued and went back, to the monastery. And the other monks asked the Buddha, "How could this be? Angulimala is fully enlightened. And how could this be that the villagers treat him so badly he gets stoned?" And the Buddha said that that no one is free from the causal conditions they might have set into place. So there were certain causal conditions that were set into place. The villagers, have this anger. And if the conditions are right, he's going to have to, receive some of those consequences. But in the midst of receiving those consequences, he's free. In the midst of receiving those consequences, he has a choice about whether to get angry at those villagers throwing rocks at him, or to get afraid, or simply to keep his presence and be friendly and peaceful and understanding and get out of there. And I suspect that that's what he did. Being an enlightened person, he didn't react with fear or anger or animosity or confusion, but rather maintained his freedom and probably, I suspect, his happiness, even with his welts. So we don't know. So the important thing I want to say is that the world of suffering and happiness for Buddhism has a lot to do with how we choose to respond to what's given to us. And what's given to us might not be to our liking, might be really bad and horrible. And it doesn't mean that we can make ourselves happy in the middle of horrible, difficult things. But there is a realm of choice there about how we choose to respond. Do we choose to respond with more aversion, with more anger, with more confusion or fear, more protectedness, or more aggression, or more ambition? Or do we choose to respond with more awareness, with attention, for example. Attention makes a big difference just to bring attention to a situation, let alone to bring loving kindness or to bring compassion or investigation. To become conscious of how we are responding to a situation is a very important part of this practice that we do. Becoming conscious of what we're doing and the intention from which what we're doing comes from. And then I'd like to end with this story. I've been wanting to read this story here for 2 or 3 years. And finally I found, hopefully, an opportunity. Abbot Anastasius had a book of very fine parchment, which was worth 20 shekels. It contained both the Old and the New Testaments in full, and Anastasius read from it daily as he meditated. Once a certain monk came to visit him, and seeing the book, made off with it. The next day, when Anastasius went to his scripture reading and found that it was missing, he knew at once that the monk had taken it. Yet he did not send after him, for fear that he might add the sin of lying to that of theft. Now the monk went into the city to sell the book. He wanted 18 shekels for it. The buyer said, "Give me the book so I may find out if it's worth that much money." With that, the buyer took the book to the holy Anastasius and said, "Father, take a look at this and tell me if you think it is worth as much as 18 shekels." Anastasius said, "Yes, it is a fine book, and at 18 shekels it is a bargain." So the buyer went back to the monk and said, "Here is your money. I showed the book to Father Anastasius, and he said it was worth 18 shekels." The monk was stunned. Was that all he said? Did he say nothing else? No, he did not say a word more than that. "Well, I have changed my mind, and I don't want to sell the book after all." Then he went back to Anastasius and begged him with many tears to take the book back. But Anastasius said gently, "No, brother, keep it. It is my present to you." But the monk said, "If you do not take it back, I shall have no peace." After that, the monk dwelt with Anastasius for the rest of his life. So if Anastasius had gotten angry, it would have been a very different consequence. But he offered his generosity, in a sense, and his compassion. And there was a different consequence that happened. And it's very interesting, the monk at the end said, "If you don't take the book back, I'll have no peace of mind." That when we're clearly enough aware of the suffering or the transgression that we have done, I think there's a naturally, in a healthy way, a sense of remorse, a sense of remorse that arises for us, and a wanting to make amends the best we can. And so this monk, and that's part of the world of karma, the world of intentions and the consequence of intentions, to feel it, to feel the negative consequences, feel the remorse, feel the empathetically what has caused the world around us, and have it really sit for us in a serious, heavy way, is what happens. And many people, when they meditate, the world of mindfulness, of paying attention carefully, will notice how certain things that they did, sometimes 20 years ago, or maybe recently, kind of suddenly, oh my God, you know, and you feel terrible about what you've done, and you want to go make amends in some way, because you don't feel comfortable about yourself until you've done that. So the world of karma is the world of intention, and the world of intention belongs to the world of right now, nowhere else. So what is your intention right now? What is the intention which you meet this moment with, the next moment? What's the intention which you meet the person that you're talking to? What's the intention? What's the intention? And if you take care of this world of intention and take care of it like a garden, tending a garden carefully, intention will flower beautifully in your life. So enjoy your karma.